superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
His movies were intentionally offensive before his runaway mainstream hit.
It's the most devious movie I ever made because it's playing in your local grade school.
We'll catch up with John Waters. But first... The attack on Israel shocked the world.
My initial response was just shock and not having any appreciation for the magnitude of the attack.
But brought the Twin Ports Muslim and Jewish communities together.
The best way to feel safer is to actually reach out across communities.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The world is still reeling from the horrific attack by Hamas against Israel nearly 2 weeks ago. Most affected are the Jewish and Muslim communities, with more than 1,000 killed in the terrorist attacks, some in nothing short of atrocities. Palestinian civilians also suffered in Israel's initial retaliation in Gaza, including, as in Israel, children. Around the world, there are few in the Jewish and Muslim communities who have been unaffected by the war, through relatives or friends directly hit by firepower or kidnappings, or in simply having visited the areas themselves. That's true in our region, but there's also a bright spot. The two largest houses of worship for both communities have a long-standing relationship with one another, and the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports sent a personal greeting to be read at Temple Israel at a special service following the attack. In response, on Sunday, congregants from Temple Israel joined those from the Islamic Center to remove graffiti left by vandals at the mosque earlier in the week. Two who participated in the removal are here with us today. John Dahl from the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports and Debbie Friedman from Temple Israel. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, John and Debbie.
Glad to be here.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So where were you and what were you doing when you heard of the attacks? Let's start with you, Debbie.
Well, I was home on Saturday, just read about it online on my New York Times. And I was getting ready the next day. I was having a gathering in my sukkah. So that's what I was doing. I was like cooking and getting ready for people to come over in the sukkah because it was Sukkot.
Right. Sukkah, for those who are not familiar with it, is the hut that is part of the holiday of Sukkot, where Jews have a meal outdoors and in the open environment.
Yeah, I love that holiday, and we always build a sukkah in our yard, and so I was, that's what I was doing that day.
I'm imagining, myself and the whole rest of the world, initially you heard attacks, and obviously that was pretty bad, but we didn't know the extent of it, or as we said, the atrocities until later that day.
Right.
John, how about you?
You know, I think it was the same way as Debbie. I usually go to the New York Times for my news, just because oftentimes what you hear online is almost unbelievable, and this was almost unbelievable, but I had to believe it was actually happening because the New York Times was printing it. And I think my initial response was just shock and not having any appreciation for the magnitude of the attack and how many people were suffering.
Right. The Twin Ports has a small Muslim and Jewish population each. Do you feel you share some of the same experiences just on a normal day of navigating the larger society?
To be honest, I think when we had our recent event of graffiti at the mosque, I did immediately think about the Jewish synagogue because my sense was that if we were being targeted or if we were vulnerable, then that was probably equally true for our Jewish neighbors. And so I think there is a sense, as I'll speak for Muslims, but I suspect maybe this is also true for Jewish people, of, you know, being a bit of a minority group in a larger community and hopefully being welcomed by the community. And for the large part, we do in Duluth. But I think with the graffiti that we had, I immediately thought about my fellow minority group and has anything like this ever happened to them before?
And I want to get obviously more to that story in a moment. Debbie, what's your feeling again about the shared experiences? Or just now I was explaining what a sukkah was, so I'm sure that most of our listeners in the area wouldn't be completely familiar with it. On a good day, explanations, are they part of normal life?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, and there weren't very large numbers of Jewish people in my community, but, you know, it was a lot different to be in Massachusetts, where just overall there's way more Jewish people. And you don't notice being a minority as much since I moved to Duluth. So once I moved here, I felt like I have more responsibility in a way to, you know, or to speak up or explain things. And when something like that, like graffiti happens, I think that if it happens to our building, it feels like I'm being targeted. And I kind of think that that's probably how it felt, you know, when it happens on a mosque, you feel targeted.
Mm-hmm. I just want to reflect back on what Debbie said, because I do agree with that. You know, I think in larger communities, it's probably more common to see a woman wearing a hijab or a man wearing a yarmulke. But those individuals might stand out a little bit more in Duluth. It seems like there's an added weight to what we say and what we do, because we realize we probably are being observed a little bit more than we might be in a larger community.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of leads to the responsibility of being an ambassador, if you will. If you're the one wearing the hijab or the yarmulke and somebody doesn't know it, they may be, in the literal sense of the word, ignorant. It's not necessarily negative, but they just don't know. And if you don't tell them what it is, they're not going to find out.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what have some of the activities in the past been between the two congregations? Getting together isn't always based on something negative.
Sure. Well, so I'm a relative new member of the mosque, but the event that comes to my mind was this last year for Ramadan. We invited members of Temple Israel to come on a Saturday to break the fast, and we had a shared communal meal in our dining area. And what I remember from that night was both prayers that were said in Arabic and also in Hebrew. And just sort of, I think members of the mosque, we were thrilled that our Jewish brothers and sisters came. And what I remember from that night was what was a very innocent question from a Muslim woman who asked a gentleman about the yarmulke. I think it may have been Rabbi David. And so the woman was just curious about how does the yarmulke stay on the head, particularly on the head of somebody who might be, like myself, a little bit follicularly challenged, we're bald. And so, and I remember how wonderful the question was and how wonderful the response was. And there seemed to be this similarity in terms of talking about dress that might, you know, stand out in a community. I remember the way that evening ended was, I was anxious for more, and I think that was the intent, that our communities would come together again, and hopefully that will continue again.
Debbie, you've been involved in activities before, too.
Yeah, it was before COVID, I know, that I went to, on their invitation, to a Saturday evening meal. People all went to pray in their sanctuary, and I was, able to observe that, and yeah, I remember really being welcomed and enjoying the evening, and it was a while ago. I think COVID kind of got in the way of a lot of things for a long time. So.
Well, yeah, it did redefine everything in the entire world and, of course, in our region. But the main thing was that you didn't need an introduction to the mosque and to, you know, individuals there.
Yes. So I hadn't met John before, but I knew a few others.
We're speaking with John Dahl from the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports and Debbie Friedman from Temple Israel. They're among members of both congregations and others who've reached out to one another in the wake of the attacks in Israel and its retaliation in Gaza. And unfortunately, while comparatively far minor, but still disturbing, vandalism at the mosque here. So, John, tell me what happened.
So I noticed the graffiti outside of the mosque actually the day after the attack in Israel. So it would have been Sunday. I was mowing the lawn, and I noticed on the side of the mosque in three different places, somebody had taken a can of yellow spray paint and sprayed on some words. And my initial thought was irritation, because we had been vandalized once before in the past 2 years. And then I very quickly wondered if this had anything to do with perhaps the mosque being targeted because of current events in Israel and Gaza. And then almost, Robin, within that same first 10 minutes, I immediately thought about the temple and wondered, has something like this happened there? And if it did, you know, how can we help one another? Because I don't think I was aware at that point how many threats were being made to U.S. mosques and synagogues in light of current events. But I felt a little bit vulnerable there, but I also immediately thought about, I wonder if my Jewish neighbors were feeling that way too.
Again, it sounds like you get a trickling of information. You're trying to figure out what it is. I mean, the defacing is horrible, and nobody should be doing that no matter what they're writing. But right, immediately you're wondering if it affects other people, if it's happened widespread or just yours. Debbie, what was your response when you heard about that? And I'll point out that Temple Israel has stepped up its security in the last couple of years and has new doors and new rules for when they're open during services or not. But what was your response when you heard about the mosque?
Yeah, so I didn't hear that happened until we were gathered on Thursday evening at Temple Israel for that special gathering. And as soon as the attacks happened, and the more we heard about it, I feel, you feel less safe. Over the past several years, pretty much since 2016, there's been quite a precipitous increase in hate crimes, against many people, and definitely anti-Semitic, incidents have been increasing. Yeah, you feel less safe. I know that, it brings, the memory of what happened, the terrible fire that happened a couple years ago at the Third Street Shul. We didn't know for several days whether that was a accident or whether it was an actual, targeted, crime. And it was, it felt scary.
And you're referring to the fire at the Orthodox synagogue on 3rd Street in Duluth that indeed did turn out to be an accident by a person experiencing homelessness. But I think we have a consistent theme here that when you hear about something, you don't know exactly what it is, what's the extent, and, that's got to be a feeling of nervousness. So tell us about the painting event on Sunday, John.
So what happened was I almost immediately thought maybe we should contact the synagogue and just let them know that this happened, but also not just to notify them, but ask if they would be willing to come and help. I think I was a little bit nervous at first about making that request or asking that, just because I know that feelings are so heightened because of current events. And I also know that we're also feeling almost sort of a paralysis of sadness. And so there's an expression, there's an Arabic expression, it's husnutan, which means beautiful intent. And so the assumption is to make that of other people, that other people do have a beautiful intent. And so I was hopeful that the request would be received well, and it absolutely was. I think, and maybe Debbie can speak to this, but my sense was that it felt like an honor to be asked to come and help to paint, because I know I certainly would have felt that way for us if the shoe was on the other foot. So we asked if, and it was really kind of a short-term request. We didn't have a lot of time to plan for it. The police told us that we should probably remove the graffiti soon so that it doesn't invite more graffiti. But the request went out, and we heard that a few members from Temple Israel would come over. We didn't know how many people from Temple Israel or even from the Zionic Center would show up. But the hope was that we would have a couple of hands to that weren't afraid of getting some paint on them, and then we would paint over it. And so we had a little issue with a color match, but we did get a color match that worked out well. And to be honest, I think the outside of the mosque looks better than it ever has before. So I think it was a great event, not only for the painting, but maybe for also the fellowship that happened afterwards when we shared some food in the basement.
Yes, I agree with all that you're saying. And that is how I felt. And I felt really appreciative of the being asked to do this, because when something like this happens, it's the best way to feel safer and the best way to feel better about the situation is to actually reach out across, different communities, different history, different experiences, and be doing things together. And something tangible, like repairing, like painting the building, that's such a hands-on, real thing that we could all be doing together. And I was just really grateful to be asked. And I know there were so many people that saw the email on our Tikkun Olam email list that were like, oh, I can't be there. I can't, you know, I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to be doing that. And it probably would have been a lot more people if we could have, you know, and we didn't need that many people, but there were definitely a lot that would have wanted to.
Right.
I sort of joked afterwards, Debbie, that we did such a good job that I thought maybe members from both the temple and the mosque should get together and form a painting company, or at least volunteer paint.
You know, it's a kind of irony that obviously whoever did this, and John, you could tell us if there's an investigation or what, but, you know, this was the total opposite of what they were trying to achieve, I assume. They were, you know, expressing hate or at least ignorance and not the innocent ignorance I referred to earlier, and yet they end up bringing people even more together and doing something constructively.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think God works in mysterious ways, and I definitely felt the presence of God on Sunday when we all got together.
Mm-hmm. Debbie, you said both the word repair as part of the tangible work you were doing there, and then you said the Tikkun Olam Committee of Temple Israel. That's the social action committee, and the words in Hebrew mean to repair the world. So I didn't know that it was meant to be taken literally, but you did actually repair a small part of the world.
That's right. And that is such an important value of Jewish tradition, is to work to repair the world. And this felt like one of those opportunities.
Oh, I love that R word, repair. In Islam, it's every Muslim really considers part of their responsibility is to be a refuge for humanity. And so maybe I'll just throw that another R word there. And I definitely felt better after Sunday too. I think as a Muslim in Duluth, I felt less alone, I think, because of Debbie's community coming over.
So this isn't all past tense. You're getting together in the future as well.
That's correct. In fact, we've been the mosque members have been invited by Temple Israel to come for a Shabbat service on December 15th. And that will actually be my second time coming to the temple. I did attend a bat mitzvah there once before. So I think we're so honored and excited about the opportunity to do that.
Well, no one has an easy answer for the Middle East, but can the rest of the world learn something from our shared communities?
I hope so. I hope that big actions are born out of the seeds of small actions. And it certainly was a small action that we had on Sunday. The small action, I think, was to resist paralysis and to do something and to not be afraid to speak to somebody who you might not speak with on a day-to-day basis. There's an expression in Islam, trust in God, but tie your camel. And so I think it's important that we do try to act to be with one another in small acts of peace, because I think Debbie really hit it on the nail. The way that security and alleviation and suffering will happen is from peace. So it's absolutely worth making an attempt for it, no matter how small the attempt.
Debbie?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that being together and building those connections makes a lot of difference. And, you know, when we were all able to sit around and eat some food together and drink some fresh cider together and talk makes all the difference. And you go away feeling like you have a deeper understanding. I think this is kind of silly, but really it's kind of a learning experience that it got put on the news. You know, John and I were interviewed, and I don't know if you noticed, John, but I watched the interview on, and there were some pretty sloppy mistakes that the reporters made.
Yes, there was, including Temple Islam, I think was said.
Yeah, they called the Temple of Islam, and then they said, yeah, and they said Hamas invaded Gaza. It kind of made me realize that people don't, you know, I feel like I don't know everything about this situation, and it's a complicated situation, but people really don't understand even like the basics. Maybe even if you're a reporter, you know, a reporter on the news, they didn't get some very basic things right. And so I kind of feel like there needs to be more chance for, you know, people to meet and talk and get, you know, different perspectives and learn, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think you just raised to an even higher level, more degrees of ignorance. And I'm sure our local reporter friend obviously did not do it on purpose. And I will tell you this reporter will do my darndest to make sure I don't make these mistakes right now. So
it's an opportunity to make those. I mean, I actually emailed the reporter and said, you know, you probably should fix those errors.
Yeah.
Actually, Debbie, I'm glad you did try and contact the reporter, Debbie. Nick from the mosque also thought we should contact them, and I hadn't done that, so I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with John Dahl from the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports and Debbie Friedman from Temple Israel. They're among members of both congregations and others who have reached out to one another in the wake of the attacks in Israel and its retaliation and a paint over of graffiti at the mosque. Thank you for joining us, Debbie and John.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you, John and Robin. Thanks so much.
Coming up, his movies were intentionally offensive before he made his runaway mainstream film.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
They put me in special ed just because of my hair.
The times, they're changing.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. His movies range from outlandish cult classics, intentionally so, to a breakout hit that's earned a second life on Broadway and even community theater, including our own Duluth Playhouse. Director John Waters is a cinematic icon enshrined with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, yet that would have seemed a million miles away from his early films, shot mostly in his native Baltimore, depicting people and behaviors that pushed the boundaries far beyond anything the Hollywood censors even knew what to deal with. Most famous is Pink Flamingos, the 1972 black comedy featuring his perennial star Divine, proudly described as the filthiest person alive. All that changed with his 1988 film Hairspray, also starring Divine, but featuring mainstream actors as well, including Ricky Lake, Debbie Harry, Sonny Bono, and Jerry Stiller. It later became a Broadway musical, now on the circuit in venues like the Duluth Playhouse, with the likes of family fairs such as The Sound of Music. You can see both his mainstream and over-the-top work at the West Theater in Duluth through several showings throughout next week, and on Wednesday and Thursday, he'll be appearing there as well. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, John Waters.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. Looking forward to coming. I was in three cities. I just came back from Dallas, Houston, and Tulsa. So I'm looking forward to coming your way.
And you go right into my next question, which is, have you been to Duluth before or Superior?
You know, I've been doing this for 50 years, and I used to do it all in the college circuit when that was much bigger than it is now, because today young people don't want to see art films. They want to go see a big... They want to go to a mall and see a comic book movie and then riot afterwards. So that market at the colleges has calmed down a little. So I might have been there in that period, but I've been doing it so long, I can't tell. So I get to the theater and then I have a flashback. Oh, I was here. I remember.
Well, the theater wouldn't have been here because it's rehabbed and restored from a long time ago.
Yes, I usually play in rehabbed and restored theaters, and I guess you could say that about myself. I'm rehabbed and restored.
All right, we'll just leave that at that. I think you would remember Duluth and Superior, though, and certainly Lake Superior.
You know, I'm never in real life when I'm on tour. I get in the car, I go to the airport, I get in another car, I go to the hotel, I go to the theater, and I go back to the hotel and to the airport.
Right.
So people always say, how is it? I don't know, you know. And Gore Vidal said a really funny thing about the weather. He said, I'm way too intelligent. No one speaks to me about the weather. And also somebody else said, I only notice the weather when it stops me. And that is true on tour. But I'm looking forward to it. That's why I go to on tour all the time, is to meet the fans, which are you really need to stay in touch with. And Elton John told me that a long time ago. The day you stop touring, it's over.
Mm-hmm. And he's been to Duluth, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure you know. I love to go to places I haven't been. I have been there before, and no. And I've driven across the country a lot. What's the nearest interstate to where you are?
Interstate 35.
No, but 70, 80, or 90, that's the one that goes the whole way.
35 goes north and south, so you can get on at the Mexican border and go straight up to Duluth.
I see. So it would be lower if you're going across the country. Right.
Right. Got to go north and south.
Yeah.
Well, I've been familiar with your works, and at one time in the 1970s, I've seen pretty much all of them. Who was going to your movies back then other than me? And what was the attraction? And I should tell our audience that these were clearly, as I said, over the top, sexual, describing every type of activity you can think of, and a few you couldn't.
They were joyous. They made fun of the rules the outsider community lived in, not the rules that our parents we fled. And nowadays, the outsider community has more rules than my parents did. So it's come full circle. My audience, I always had an audience, even when we showed them in church basements. It was minorities that didn't fit in their own minorities. Gay people who didn't get along in the gay world. Black people who didn't get along in the black world. And they all had a sense of humor about it. And they were all kind of angry, but they made fun of themselves. And they dressed well. I think that is probably sums up my audience even today.
Mm-hmm. But they weren't necessarily seeing themselves in these films.
They felt liberated by them. They felt like here was a world they could fit in. I wrote a book called Role Models, which was the same people that did it for me, Tennessee Williams, people that made me realize I didn't have to live this life that I read about in Life magazine or they told us in school. There was another world, and that other world was Bohemia. And that was all oddballs hanging out together. I'm not a separatist in any way. I don't think gay is better than straight. I think everybody has different extremes, and that's kind of what I'm interested in. But right from the beginning, I made fun of myself, and that's how I think I've had this long a career.
Mm-hmm. You've been asked this a million times, I'm sure, but it's my turn. What happened in 1988 with Hairspray?
Well, that's the most devious movie I ever made, because it's playing in your local grade school, and two men are singing a love song to each other, and it encourages interracial dating, but people don't get it. It's a sneak attack, and I have never been hassled about drag in a play, even when a play is in grade school, because the fact that Edna is often played by a man is a secret between the actors and the audience. Tracy Turnblad doesn't think her mother's trans. So it confuses censors. They don't know what to do. And I keep saying it's too late. I'm so amazed that people get so upset about drag. It's a little late. It's like the hotel industry not blinking when Airbnb came by. It's too late. It's already been accepted by Mid-America through RuPaul. They're too late.
Mm-hmm. What about in Florida, though, in places like that?
Well, Florida, I think we should have just straight don't say hate instead of don't say gay.
All right.
Also, in Florida, Hairspray has never been hassled.
Oh, okay. Well, that's important to know.
Never has it been hassled anywhere. Because the message is so upbeat. How can you hassle that, really? And that's the thing. That's why it was a Trojan horse. And even I, when I wrote it, didn't think it was going to be more mainstream than any of my other movies. And when I got a PG rating, the distributor was shocked and wanted me to put in one cuss word so we'd get a PG-13. And I said, no, no, let's keep the shock value is that we made a family-friendly movie starring Divine.
But you did have mainstream actors. So how did that happen?
Well, I had done that before. I had in Polyester, I had Tab Hunter.
Yes.
So I had already gone out to you know, more traditional Hollywood stars, a little unconventional, but to put them in with my regulars like Ming Stoll and Divine and everything. So I had done that, and in Desperate Living, I had Liz Renee, who was a famous burlesque star that had dated Mickey Cohen, and she ran up Hollywood Boulevard totally naked when she was in her 50s to promote her show, which was really a woman after my own heart. We're all carnies.
All right. We're speaking with director John Waters. He and several of his films will be appearing at the West Theater in Duluth. The films are playing all week. He'll be there on Wednesday and Thursday, October 25th and 26th. Let's hear a trailer from one of them, Pink Flamingos.
Hello, moviegoers. This is Mr. J speaking to you for Dreamland Studios. This beautiful mobile home you see before you is the current hideout of the notorious beauty Divine, the filthiest person alive.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be, you know that there are.
You are about to receive into your community the filthiest people alive.
That was a trailer from the John Waters cult classic Pink Flamingos, most of which was video behind the Cat Stevens song that we couldn't show you even if we could bring you pictures on the radio. John Waters will be appearing, along with several of his films, at the West Theater in Duluth next Wednesday and Thursday, October 25th and 26th. So one of your films I saw way back when was Desperate Living, I think when it was new, which is incidentally, I think, one of the few without Divine, correct?
Yes, it was. Divine was doing the play and couldn't do the part he was going to play. Mole, the lesbian character who gets a sex change, which was very, very early in that. And
well, that's
probably
that, yeah.
my...
That's what I wanted to ask.
It's probably my grimmest movie. But today, at some point, there was a little resistance to it from the trans community. But nowadays, all the young ones go and cheer and laugh all the way through it because it has a positive message.
Well, let me ask you that. Yeah, you're hitting exactly. Yes, it features transgender issues and graphic depiction of a sexual reassignment and then more graphic representation of that person changing back. That kind of flies in the face, though, of the transgender community today, which says gender identity isn't capricious and isn't just a matter of choice.
I don't think it's funny, but I do. Can I chuckle when I hear conservative parents telling their trans children, can't you just be gay? There is some humor in the new thing. Yes, I'm a leftover loser from the initial sexual revolution. This one has done it all. It's made the left and the right nervous. I salute them.
And has there been pushback about that depiction from the transgender
nope.
community or no?
Not at all. They were all, I try out my show every year at the John Waters Summer Camp, which seems suddenly this year every person is trans now. There's no hipsters even anymore. There's no boys. There's no girls. Everyone's trans. It got accepted by young people really quickly. I mean, it took gay rights 2 centuries. It seems like it took trans rights a year. I think there's a new vocabulary, and all the ones I meet, nobody complains about pronouns or says the word woke anymore, except Republicans.
All right. You spoke of my...
I have my pronoun. It's the royal we.
That's a good one.
Like
yeah.
Queen Elizabeth and her nation. That's me and the filthiest people alive. I can never check that when it says pronoun you want to pick. It says he, she, or them, but it doesn't say royal we.
In all seriousness, we is actually, you know, an answer to people understanding each other, because if you're saying we, you're including all of us.
Well, no, I think we in the royal way includes you and your nation. That's the people that believe in what you believe in.
All right. Well, you spoke of other cultural changes as innocent as the word fat.
Well, no, that's the new F word. You can say the old F word on national television now, but you can't say the new F word. And even Bruce Wagner, a novelist I like very much, had his book canceled because he refused to change it, and the character in it was purposely eating as much as she could so she would be the fattest person in America to break the record.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a perfectly legitimate use of the word. You have, my mother always used to say, she's not fat, she's big boned, she has a glandular problem. But to me, I don't know, it seems like many of the big girls I know proudly use that word. They've taken it back.
Hmm. All right. And yes, you were about to say, on the other hand, some of the vulgarity you used back then is totally mainstream today. We're way beyond the 7 words you can't say.
Oh, I have a whole thing in my show about words that used to be very politically correct that are now, you can't even dare say out loud. So vocabulary is very important. Yeah. And I think there is humor in it all. That's what I think. You never make the enemy feel stupid. You make them feel smart even when they are stupid, and then make them laugh and they'll listen.
I think I'm getting the thesis here. There were words that were not obscene that you can't say today now, but there were words that were obscene that you can say today.
Yes, definitely. The F word, they say it on television, the old-fashioned F word. My favorite was in King Flamingos, which is obscene in a courtroom. It played recently on Turner Classics, which I couldn't believe. And the little blurb in the program said, fat woman lives in trailer. That's the best review I ever got. That's simplifying it. But it really made me laugh. Like some apologist was paid to think up this description. But it's every day... vocabulary and words and humor, it's quite complicated these days, and my show is about that, the complications of the new sexual revolution. Yes, that's why it's called Devil's Advocate.
Well, that show again will be at the West Theater in Duluth next Wednesday and Thursday, October 25th and 26th, where John Waters will appear. Let's hear another trailer, this one of material we can play on the radio, from Hairspray.
Madison time. Hit it.
Baltimore, 1962.
You're looking good. A bit
the heyday
gone.
Of hairdos and hair don'ts.
We shall well, overcome someday.
Not with that hair, you won't.
They put me in special ed just because of my hair.
The times, they're changing. Something's blowing in the wind.
Let's get naked and smoke.
And that was a trailer from Hairspray, the mainstream movie by John Waters. He'll be appearing, along with several of his films, at the West Theater in Duluth next Wednesday and Thursday, October 25th and 26th. What's next for John Waters?
Well, I'm now allowed to say part of it because the Writers Guild strike is over, but my last novel, my only novel, was optioned to make a movie, and I just turned in the script this week, so we'll see. It's called Liar Mouth. Yeah, the book came out last year.
All right. Thank you for joining us, John Waters.
All right. Thank you.
Starring Sonny Bono, Ruth Brown, Devine, Michael St. Gerard, Debbie Harry, Ricky Lake, Jerry Stiller, and Sean Thompson.
Coming up, the regional news and review.
The new comedy from John Waters.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Danielle Kading of WPR News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, there's an updated wolf management plan for the state, but no final decisions have yet been determined?
That's right. And the latest in that this week is that the Wisconsin Senate advanced a Republican-authored bill that would require the State Department of Natural Resources to set a statewide population goal for wolves as part of that plan. The measure passed with all Democrats voting against it on Tuesday, and that bill now heads to the Assembly. And the proposal came after the DNR nixed a statewide population goal as part of its first major update to the wolf management plan. And that plan sets the framework for managing wolves and setting quotas for a wolf hunt if the animal is delisted as an endangered species. Republican State Senator Rob Stafschult says lawmakers crafted the bill to make sure that Wisconsin can delist wolves as an endangered species because without a goal, he said, that would reduce the chances of delisting since the DNR has always had a goal under its existing plan. And that current plan was first written in 1999, and it set a goal of 350 wolves. Right now, we're at about 1,000 in Wisconsin. And some hunters and farmers have pushed the agency to maintain that goal because they want to reduce the population and conflicts with livestock and dogs. But DNR data shows only a small number of the state's 64,000 farms encounter wolf attacks. Democrats say that GOP lawmakers' bill would tie the hands of the DNR and set an unscientific goal for managing wolves. And animal rights groups and tribes say that the wolf needs protection in Wisconsin, due in part to the fact that the state mandates a wolf hunt when it's not listed as an endangered species. And so as lawmakers debate this bill, the Natural Resources Board is set to take up the DNR's plan next week, which is now mostly made up of fresh faces.
Well, yes. Speaking of the Department of Natural Resources Board, a few members of that board will no longer be on it, and that includes some from our region.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. This week, the Republican-controlled Senate also voted to fire a host of Democratic appointees to state boards and commissions, and that includes four of Governor Tony Evers' appointees to the Natural Resources Board. And that board sets policy for the DNR on sometimes contentious issues like wolf hunting regulations or its wolf management plan and water quality standards for PFAS. And so from our region, longtime conservationist Sandra D. Knotts, who teaches in Drummond, was among those rejected by the Senate. Also, lawmakers fired Dylan Jennings, who is a Bad River Tribal member and associate director at the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland. Democrats said that Republicans were rejecting qualified nominees because of partisanship, and they called it the latest example of an attempt to just undermine state government. Republicans rejected those notions and argued that some appointees weren't up to speed on natural resources issues, They also took issue with comments that Evers appointees made on Wolf management and said that those members would have also been willing to violate state law that limits the cost of agency regulations that can be passed without legislative approval. So the governor has blasted this action by the Republican-controlled Senate. Immediately afterward, he appointed four new members to the Natural Resources Board. And a former DNR secretary said both parties have been playing political games with the DNR board and said that that's time to stop.
All right. Well, Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander will be retiring, and this is his choice, not a vote by any lawmakers.
That's right, Robin. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander is going to be retiring at the end of January next year. He has served more than 25 years with the Superior Police Department, and he's been in various roles, including captain of investigations. And he first became the city's police chief in 2015. Under his leadership, the department advanced training of officers on fair and impartial policing. They adopted body cameras, invested in a position to provide coordinated response to mental health and crisis calls. And also the department started the Pathways to Hope program. And that initiative took a different approach to how law enforcement responds to crimes stemming from addiction. Superior Mayor Jim Payne called Alexander the best police chief in Wisconsin, saying that his retirement is a loss for Superior. And he highlighted the chief's respect for every citizen in the community and commitment to service. And Chief Alexander told the Superior Telegram that the job has offered an opportunity to make a positive impact in people's lives. And he plans to work at the Pequawan Inn outside of Duluth and teach part-time at UW Superior once he's retired.
All right. Well, Rick, moving to the Minnesota side, actually, we have to get there first. Can I take the Blatnik?
You can for now, but on Monday, October 30, motorists that use the Blatnik Bridge to travel to Duluth may need to reroute their trips for a while. As the Minnesota Department of Transportation announced Wednesday in a news release that the Duluth-bound side of the Interstate 535 bridge will be closed for approximately 1 week, beginning on that date. Originally, the plan had been to close the Duluth-bound lanes Thursday, October 19, but this was postponed to allow for the reopening of northbound and southbound Interstate 35 to two lanes of traffic in each direction. The closure is part of the Twin Ports Interchange project. Superior-bound traffic will not be affected by this closure. According to the Minnesota Department of Transportation's news release, when the closure is complete, northbound traffic through the Garfield Interchange area will reopen to single-lane access for motorists headed to Duluth and allow for direct access onto northbound I-35.
Good to know. And speaking of the Blatnik, we have a correction from a report we gave 2 weeks ago in which we said several businesses would be forced to move under a new configuration of the bridge when it's complete. One of those mentioned was Halverlines, and company officials say, in fact, the company's location should not be affected by the highway change. Well, one of our region's most popular sports is curling, and we lost a legend last week.
Yes, we did, Robin. Raymond Bud Somerville of Superior, who was a skip of the first American curling team to make a name for itself on the world stage, died on Friday, October 13, at the age of 86. Somerville, skipping with a team of Bill Strum, Al Gagne, and Tim Wright, won the final two ends of the championship match of the 1965 Scotch Cup in Perth, Scotland, marking the first time that Canada had been defeated for the world title. Somerville was a five-time national champion, a two-time world champion, and participated in Olympic demonstration tournaments in 1988 and 1992. Tributes to Somerville began rolling through the Twin Ports and throughout the curling world over the weekend. Three-time Olympian Chris Plies of Duluth posted on social media that they don't make him much better than Bud and that he was an American curling icon. Somerville was born in Superior on January 27, 1937, and started curling at the age of 11. Somerville went on to compete in 14 Wisconsin State Championship ranks, and in 1965 in Seattle, Somerville's rank broke through for its first national championship. The twilight of his competitive career lasted for several years and coincided with the rise of the sport to the attention of the International Olympic Committee. Curling was a demonstration sport at the 1988 Winter Olympic Games in Calgary, and Somerville skipped the United States team to a fourth-place finish. 4 years later, Somerville's rank had a third place finish in the demonstration event in the 1992 games in Albertville, France. Bud Somerville was the first inductee into the U.S. Curling Hall of Fame in 1984. He was also inducted into the DEC Hall of Fame in 1971.
Okay. And finally, this was one of our region's most prominent crimes, the stolen ruby red slippers from the Judy Garland Museum. Will the thief be sentenced over the rainbow?
Well, a rural Grand Rapids man testified last week that he stole a famed pair of ruby slippers from the Judy Garland Museum nearly two decades ago because he believed they contained valuable gems. 76-year-old Terry John Martin said that once he found out that they were glass, he didn't want anything else to do with them. Martin appeared in U.S. District Court on October 13 in Duluth to plead guilty to a count of theft of major artwork, providing for the first time a public admission that at least partially unravels the long-running mystery behind one of the region's most notorious crimes. Martin, who was using a wheelchair and carrying an oxygen tank, has advanced COPD and is receiving hospice care. So federal prosecutors indicated that they would not recommend any prison time in the case. Chief Judge Patrick Schultz ordered a background investigation and said he hopes to schedule a sentencing date in Duluth within the next 3 months. Martin acknowledged that he used a small sledgehammer to break into the Grand Rapids Museum in August of 2005, shattering first a glass door and then the plexiglass case that protected the pair of slippers used in the filming of the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz. He said he briefly stored the artifacts in a trailer near his home, which is about 12 miles south of the museum, before giving them to a person who sells stolen jewelry. He did not name that person and said he played no role in a later attempt to extort an insurance company. The slippers, which had been on loan to the museum from a Hollywood collector, were ultimately recovered by the FBI and the Grand Rapids Police Department in Minneapolis in July 2018. The slippers are one of four surviving pairs worn by Garland, a Grand Rapids native, in the filming of one of the most famous films of all time. They were insured at the time for $1 million, but federal agents said that they are currently appraised at more than $3.5 million. The slippers were nearing the end of a 10-week loan to the Birthplace Museum when they were stolen sometime overnight on August 27 to 28, 2005. Shattered glass and a red sequin were all that were left after an emergency exit door window was broken and the slipper's glass case was broken as well. It was later discovered that the museum's alarm system hadn't been set up properly to notify a private security firm. The brazen theft continued to captivate Garland's hometown, the state, and the arts community for 13 years. The police department received tips from around the world. A dive team searched the Tioga Mine Pit in 2015. An anonymous fan also offered $1 million for a reward. While the Grand Rapids police long tinkered with the investigation, the FBI said it became involved in 2017 when an extortion attempt was made against an insurance company that now owns the slippers. The agency's Minneapolis division and art crime team executed search warrants in both Minnesota and Florida and recovered the slippers in the Minneapolis sting operation, though authorities have remained tight-lipped about that part of the case. The FBI said that they recovered the slippers and then were then sent to the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., for their authenticity. Michael Shaw, the collector and acting coach who owned the slippers at the time, accepted an $880,000 payout from his insurer. The theft charge carries a maximum of 10 years in prison, though Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Greenlee said he would not argue for any incarceration and believed any supervision should be minimal due to Martin's health.
All right, case solved. And let this be a reminder that movies are fantasy and that rubies on red slippers are probably going to be made of glass. We've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, Superior Base reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And finally, the Ashland Chamber Music Society is presenting the acclaimed Kodak Quartet tonight, October 20th, at the United Presbyterian Congregational Church. In prayers for those affected by the war in Israel and Gaza, the group was kind enough to share music from one of the composers they'll be highlighting, George Ligeti, who lost members of his Hungarian Jewish family in the Holocaust. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.